There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Coming up, we hear from the HR expert who President Trump handpicked to run a major project across the US. And we'll be looking at foreigners being allowed now to buy property in free zones in Abu Dhabi. But first, we're talking about the business of fake reviews. Amazon reportedly is flooded with them, but are they actually illegal?
We are joined in the studio now by Fiona Robertson, who is a media and entertainment lawyer at Al-Tamimi & Co. Fiona, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Were you surprised at all by this report coming out from Which about the number of fake five-star reviews that were found?
Not even a little bit. Not even a little bit. It's been well known for some time that a lot of online reviews are fake. And in fact, fake reviews themselves go back over 100 years.
When we're talking about fake reviews, are we talking about me asking my mum to write something nice about my book, or are we talking about larger, concerted, possibly paid-for campaigns?
Well, we're definitely talking about the larger paid-for campaigns. There are huge farms of writers that will do these reviews for you for as little as a couple of dollars. So that they'll do 2,000 or 3,000 in a day.
A lot of it is electronically generated.
Some are, yes, but most of them, from what we understand, are actually generated by writers.
We've been talking about Amazon because that's what Which was looking at. They were looking at that one site, but presumably this takes place all over the place.
Yeah, look, TripAdvisor and Yelp have also been suffering with this for some time, and it's been an industry problem. They've been trying to deal with it, you know, setting up different types of technology so that they can try and track where these fake reviews are coming from. So they track language and stuff to try and work out if it's bots. And then, of course, if 1,000 reviews hits one particular site in a very short period of time, that flags on their system and then they go and check it out.
But it does push them up the rankings. I mean, you've got
absolutely.
A case of a restaurant in London.
Yeah, look, it's one of my favourite cases. It's The Shed at Dulwich Hill, and it was a guy, he's a reporter, and he decided to set up a restaurant on TripAdvisor, and he got all of his friends and everybody he knew to post fake positives on it. And he managed to get it very, very quickly into the top 1,000 restaurants in London. And through a concerted push, he actually managed to make it the number one restaurant in London on TripAdvisor. It had never served a meal.
So it does work, in other words.
It really, really does work.
But is it illegal? Is it illegal to do this?
Look, if you're paying somebody to essentially advertise, then you're in this region, you're going to have issues with the National Media Council and the media regulations, because obviously you have to post real reviews. You can't do anything that's going to be deceptive to the consumers. You've also got issues under the Consumer Protection Act regulations as well. And I suppose if you wanted add a push, we could have a look at a penal code issue.
What liability is there of the platform? If I buy something because it's got a load of five-star reviews and they turn out to be fake and the goods turn out to be shoddy, does the platform bear any responsibility for that?
No, they wouldn't necessarily be held liable unless perhaps they knew about it and didn't act. Then you could possibly say that they were liable. But on the whole, it would be the advertiser themselves that are liable.
Have there been cases about that where somebody said, look, I bought that on the basis of a five-star review. It's turned out to be false and it's nothing like what you advertise. And what are those sort of sites doing? Are they holding up their hand saying, okay, look, yeah, we'll take it back, no questions asked?
Well, we're not seeing anything in this part of the world at this stage. We'd love to see some cases. Obviously, it's always nice to see the law in action. We are seeing cases in the US, and we saw quite a lot of cases in the US coming up to about 2016. And then the federal government took matters into their own hands, and they passed a law about ensuring that reviews are real.
What about bad reviews as revenge?
Oh, I know. Aren't they fabulous? Look, and this is a huge issue on TripAdvisor where, you know, the hotel down the road, the restaurant down the road starts posting negative reviews. But it's that same issue. If you're paying somebody to try and contempt your competitors in this part of the world, that is actually part of the advertising law. You're not allowed to do that.
What if you're not paying anyone to do it? You're doing it yourself.
If you're doing it yourself, I think you'd have the same issue.
Is there any reliable way that would stand up in a court of law to track where these reviews are coming from?
There have been some cases in the States where the regulator has demanded that Yelp or TripAdvisor or Google actually hand up the anonymous information or the information behind the anonymous persona.
So the IP address that the
reviews
come from.
That's right, so that they can track them down. And they have actually had to do that in the States. We've not seen it here yet, but it can be done in some countries.
But what do we do in the meantime? How do you spot a fake review as opposed to a real one?
Look, I personally find it reasonably easy. I think if it reads like something that's been written by a professional, you know, as humans, we're quite flawed and we're quite emotional when we react online. So you can generally read that into the review. You can hear the emotion. But if it feels like it's written by PR, it was probably written by a writer.
And what advice do you give anyone who is opening a new, I mean, we're saying, talking about restaurants now, a new restaurant, who wants to do a bit of positive PR, thinks that if they get, I don't know, all the staff and a bunch of friends to put out reviews, what do they need to be mindful of?
It has to be truthful. It has to be honest. Just if you've got people coming into your restaurant and they have a great time, there's nothing wrong with saying to them, hey, could you post something about it? You know, please name the waiter, tell them about the entrees. There's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. That's a genuine review.
Doesn't bode well for the sites in the end, though, because what they built is trust. And if you destroy that trust in the veracity of the article, then it's almost game over.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the sites, it's a PR disaster.
Yeah. Mm.
Thanks very much for joining us. Fiona Robertson is a media entertainment lawyer at Al-Tamimi & Co. We appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
Liz has just written in saying, the thing that really put me off review sites was that I Googled Pacific Ocean and it had a 3.5 rating. She's right. I'm on Yelp, Pacific Ocean, 30 reviews. It's got 4 stars now. It's improving. Why are we talking about this today, guys?
This is because the UK consumer magazine, which with a question mark after it, revealed this week that certain products on Amazon had been given 5-star ratings. And that was despite the magazine's expert reviewers, they were headphones and they were electronics reviewers, not having heard of the products. 100 of the 5-star ratings have been given in a single day. And this is the products they'd never heard of as well. So they thought, hang on a minute. You know, this is just fake, surely, because what it's done is pushed product that you've never heard of above all the sort of the big household names that you might expect to see in a list of headphones. So we're asking, do you read the ratings when you buy? And if so, do they actually influence your purchases? Do you rate the products online yourself? Have you come across ratings that you've thought were obviously false or inflated? And would suspiciously good ratings put you off buying a product? And I think a lot of people are in, I suppose... put off a little bit, but I think by some of the negative reviews that are out there, they stay away from negative reviews. Overly positive, I'm not sure. What sort of flavour are you getting of the response to obviously positive reviews? Brandy has a book out at the moment, Not Bad People. You've been sort of applying the test to the reviews of your own book, Brandis.
I've been to a website called fakespot.com in which you run a URL of anything that you're thinking of, you know, buying, renting, what have you, through it, and it will tell you whether the reviews are fake or not. I'd like to tell you that I did pass with flying colours, so I'm okay. I haven't got fake reviews out there, but we're hearing from a lot of people who they've had issues. Mona is one of them. She says that she will never trust reviews again after what happened to her.
I bought screen protector. It's a big size one. So they stash it in a very tiny box. Came up broken actually because of the packages. So a few days later, I got an email that if I change my review, I would get $20 credit, and it was a worst experience. So I just rejected that email and kept my review.
Prashant, meanwhile, says that on the other end of the aisle, his sister was bullied for writing an honest review.
So my sister had gone to this cafe in Karama, which has got a lot of good reviews on social media, and she just found the food average. So she didn't write anything nasty about the plate. She just thought that, you know, I didn't think it was worth the hype, but, you know, it was average food. The management got back saying, oh, well, we are sorry you didn't like it and all that jazz. Then the owner wrote back and she got vitriolic. You know, you should visit our restaurant if you didn't like it. You shouldn't discourage others. I actually saw the post. She didn't say that you shouldn't go. She just said, I probably won't go there again. So, which obviously meant that all the earlier 5 stars, I mean, looked at the pattern, and everyone who had given a 3-star got this vitriolic reply back.
That was Prashant, whose sister was bullied. Liz says this was the moment she lost faith in online reviews.
If you Google the Pacific Ocean, you'll see that someone rated it a 3.5. And it made me laugh because how do you rate the ocean? Like, how does it get a 3.5? Like, what scale do we put it on to where it gets a 5.0? So I thought it was kind of funny that even the ocean got a 3.5 and not a 5-star review.
But isn't the Pacific Ocean the ocean with that big sort of plastic island in the middle, that vortex of plastic? Maybe it only deserves a 3.5.
Maybe it's bringing its rating down. We've got some legal opinion. We spoke to Fiona Robertson from Al Tamimi Law Firm. She says that it's not just Amazon that's dealing with this problem of fake reviews.
TripAdvisor and Yelp have also been suffering with this for some time, and it's been an industry problem. They've been trying to deal with it, you know, setting up different types of technology so that they can try and track where these fake reviews are coming from. So they track language and stuff to try and work out if it's bots. And then, of course, if 1,000 reviews hits one particular site in a very short period of time, that flags on their system.
So is it illegal to post fake reviews then?
If you're paying somebody to essentially advertise, then you're in this region, you're going to have issues with the National Media Council and the media regulations, because obviously you have to post real reviews. You have to have, you can't do anything that's going to be deceptive to the consumers. You've also got issues under the Consumer Protection Act regulations as well. And I suppose if you wanted to add a push, we could have a look at a penal code issue.
I've got good news for Mr. Scott, chiropractor of New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
Well, he gets a 5-star rating.
No, he doesn't get a 5-star rating, but he's a big fan of the air fryer, which is a product which will fry French fries with minimal fat. Anyway, the various models are available. I put one of them that's for sale on a local e-commerce platform here into FakeSpot, and it's come up with an A. So that's good.
If you want a good laugh, very quickly, and you want to see what happens when communities get behind a review, there's a book on Amazon called How to Avoid Huge Ships. And the reviews are clearly...
You've got to be careful when you say that on the radio.
I said it very slowly. The reviews are clearly people who are enjoying the fact that there is indeed a book called How to Avoid Huge Ships. $73 if you want to buy it in paperback, by the way, because the reviews are a beautiful, beautiful work of fiction in themselves. No Kindle edition, given that there is a huge ship bearing down on me right now. I am extremely disappointed that I cannot get this in a digital format. Bad advice, says another 1-star review. This book misses the bigger issue. We shouldn't just be avoiding huge ships. We should be confronting them. If we spend our lives running away, then the huge ships win. And it goes on. Be careful to get the latest edition. I don't mean to be negative, but none of the reviews have addressed the fact there are 2 editions. You want to have the latest up-to-date information. Do you want to be run over by a huge ship just because you neglected to buy the latest edition? No, I didn't think so. They go on for pages, and it's just... I tell you what, I'm going to be doing that for at least an hour this Thursday.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening, you're listening to The Business Breakfast Nightcap. I'm joined by Johnny Taylor. He's the CEO for the Society of Human Resource Management in the US. And he's sitting with me now to talk about the interesting phenomena in the States at the moment, where you have exceptionally low unemployment and high job openings. You might think that it meant that all the balls were in the court of the job hunter, the would-be employee, but does it? Johnny, tell us about the challenges of this, both for employers and for employees.
So we describe it as the perfect storm. Great economy, you know, very low birth rate, which a lot of people don't realize that in the United States since the year 2000, Americans have had fewer children annually. And so you have very low birth rate, and therefore this is not something that's going to solve next year or within the next couple of years. And then finally, a very robust economy. So you put those 3 things together, and it's what we're referring to as a perfect storm. And it's creating an interesting dynamic where we have 7.3 million openings in America right now, and only 6 million people looking for jobs, which really creates a very interesting dynamic. One would think, though, much to your point, that that would automatically lead to a job seekers market, that you can be selective. And the problem is all of this is exacerbated by a skills gap. So it would be a very simple solve to say, oh, there you have it. Let's hire 6 million of those people, and you only have a 1.3 million person gap. The problem is most of those 6 million, we've learned, are chronically and in some ways permanently underemployed.
So what do our employers doing about this? How are they trying to address it?
We're finally having to invest seriously in training. You can't create more human beings at this point. And as you no doubt know, we're struggling through our immigration policies, so you can't really import it at the levels that you need. So we're having to take Americans and do two things. One, retool, reskill, upskill talent. And the other thing we're doing, which is something that we hadn't thought about a lot in the past, is going into untapped markets. So older workers. In the past, when we talked about an older worker, it was a 70-year-old person who'd come in and be a greeter at Walmart. We're now bringing older workers back into the market to be programmers, and we're investing in teaching them the newest and latest because we need them. The formerly incarcerated. It's a pretty big pool. Some 750,000 Americans every year are released from incarceration. And heretofore, if you indicated on your application that you had were convicted of a crime and had served time in a prison, you were therefore deemed ineligible for hire. And now we're saying maybe not so much. So it's really forcing us to look at non-traditional pools of talent.
Well, that all sounds like a good thing. Where's the catch?
The catch is the skills problem. So many of those very people don't have the very skills that we need. So high demand skills. And it really comes out of what is largely, and you know, America doesn't like to admit it, but we have a struggling K-12 or secondary education system. And it has not adequately prepared people for the jobs that we have today.
Are employers willing and able to invest in that training, particularly for new hires?
They're doing it at levels that I've never seen before. I was at the White House the other day for the first convening of the White House Policy Advisory Board, the first of its kind. The president, President Trump, brought together business leaders, the CEOs of Apple and IBM and Home Depot, iconic American companies, multinational companies. And he said, we've got to do something about this. And what I heard from Jenny Rometty, the CEO of IBM, for example, who sat right next to me during this meeting, is she said, I spend $500 million a year on training. And if you think about this, in the past, training was very discretionary. The idea is if you don't come here prepared to do the job, then you don't come here. CEOs now understand not so much. I've got to bring people in who may not be qualified on its face to do the job, and I've got to teach them.
Does it mean, though, that employers are hiring people that they don't really want? And if that labor shortage somehow becomes less of an issue, people might lose jobs.
Well, so there's no question that they really do want them, but they are no question, without a doubt, we are hiring people who we would not have hired in the past because they were not deemed qualified or the most competitive for the job. Yes, there's no question. Some have asked that whether or not all of this is sort of temporary. What happens if the economy slows down and we are on one of the longest economic runs in our history, you know? So it's due. And what happens then? Again, think about the fact that Americans had fewer children starting in the year 2000. We are going to graduate in 2000. We graduated in 2017-18, 3.6 million Americans from high school. That will be the same number in 2027. So 10 years later, a decade later, we will not have increased our number of graduates.
But won't robots be doing all our jobs anyway?
A lot of them, they will. But I'm reminded, you know, everyone thinks that's going to be the magic answer. Technology is going to make all of these jobs go away. Well, I give you one example, the ATM machine. Everyone was convinced the tellers were going to go away and you're going to have widespread job losses in banking because ATM machines came on the scene. And guess what? Banks are larger, have more employees now than they did 30 years ago. So it'll be a new job. That's all, a different set of jobs, but jobs nonetheless.
What about the immigration issue? We know that it's getting harder to come into the US as an immigrant and work. We know that it's an issue in the tech industry. We have a very large Indian population here in the UAE, a lot of whom will be looking to the US for their futures. Where do you see that going?
Well, much like Japan. I mean, the fact of the matter is the more acute the labor shortage becomes, the more pressure it's going to put on our elected officials and our policymakers to rethink their approaches to this. And I feel very confident that Congress is now being forced to deal with this, not as a humanitarian issue per se, or even a question of morality, right or wrong. It's a workforce issue. To your point, we have a need for human beings and we're going to have to get them wherever we get them.
Will the U.S. still be as attractive, though, to those bright things who are now having other options, other you know, the Silicon Valley of the Middle East, the Silicon Valley of Africa, whatever it happens to be springing up?
Well, you know, as a proud American, I would submit, of course, everyone's going to want to come to America. But there's no doubt, seriously, that it's going to create, as the world flattens, as there's no question that people don't always have to come to the U.S. And it's something we've been able to rely on in the past. But we still are a go-to destination country, and we have that going for us. And I don't think that's going to change in the foreseeable future.
Johnny Taylor, CEO of the Society of Human Resource Management, speaking to me in his second day in the UAE from the US. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
The Business Breakfast Nightcap
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good evening. You're listening to the Business Breakfast Nightcap. Welcome to our regular weekly property spot, Property Pulse, and Sadiq Farid, the founder and CEO of Smart Crowd, and also Lynette Abad, Director of Research and Data at Property Finder.
Can I get your view on one of our top stories, which is Abu Dhabi allowing freehold investment for foreigners in certain sectors? Now, in some senses, this is nothing new because foreigners have been able to buy real estate in Abu Dhabi for a long time. So what's changed and why is everyone in Abu Dhabi getting so excited about it? Because everyone's calling it a game changer. Sadiq, what can you tell us?
Well, the news just came out this morning. So from what I know, it's exciting. It's unique in the sense that investors are allowed to own land, specific land, instead of buying a property outright and have the option of building property on it at a future date. And I think it's a very positive sign. It's steps in the right direction. Obviously, devil's in the details once you start looking into what the optionality is for the investors. But given the whole supply-demand situation at the moment, if you have the ability to secure a nice land in a nice location and build when you're ready to live in it, I think it's a fantastic option that the investors, especially focusing towards end users looking to call UAE their home, I think it's a fantastic step in the right direction.
Lynette, what does your data tell you more broadly about demand or otherwise for real estate, residential real estate in particular, in the capital at the moment?
Well, when it comes to Abu Dhabi, there isn't much data, unfortunately. So as far as listing activity, we do see a much more higher volume of listings in Abu Dhabi than what we have, for example, over the past year. One thing that I find interesting about the news that came out this morning is there's going to be communities where not only do you buy the land, but you can choose the type of villa that you want on that land. You can choose the floor plan. You can choose the type of amenities, the type of upgrades that you want inside of that unit. This is something very unique to UAE in general. When you buy property, for example, in the States, off plan, that is very normal. You get to pick your flooring, your countertops, the type of exterior style, and that looks to be, according to the news, what you'll be able to do in Abu Dhabi as well.
Because obviously a house becomes more desirable if it's not just cookie cutter, exactly. Same as the next one and the next one beyond that. Yeah. Aldar Properties CEO Talal Al-Diaby agrees with you. He said this is a game-changing announcement for Abu Dhabi. It will further drive the maturity of Abu Dhabi's real estate market. And he said the latest changes not only boost the real estate market, but also have far-reaching impacts on the broader economy and further increase Abu Dhabi's diversification to non-hydrocarbon industries. Is it really a game changer? Is it really going to boost the market? Do you think more people are going to buy property and look at free zones and because of this?
I think so. I think that now that you have more options as an investor within Abu Dhabi, it makes it more appealing. You know, usually investors are very Dubai-centric, very Dubai-focused, because obviously we have a lot more transparency when it comes to data. And if Abu Dhabi is looking to go into that direction, that certainly will.
I was reading earlier on this week, just before the big Cityscape event in Abu Dhabi, one report, and you always get a flurry of them around Cityscape, saying that real estate prices in Abu Dhabi were between 15 to 25% undervalued by certain metrics, looking at the cost of production, cost of land, whatever it may be. Is that a buy signal, Sadiq, to you and your investors in Abu Dhabi? When you see undervalued, do you think, okay, this could be the moment to come in?
So the good thing about real estate is it's very easy, relatively easy to figure out the intrinsic value of the asset, right? But you want to be careful because you don't want to catch a falling knife either. So you have to be very selective in your homework in terms of why is the property undervalued? There has to be a reason for it. And then if there's an opportunity, absolutely, you go pick that up. And
run us through very quickly that back of an envelope, relatively easy way to value or find the intrinsic value of property.
So we focus very, very much on income generating assets or investment properties, right? So the ability for it to generate any sort of revenue, whether it's rental from a long-term or short-term perspective. So we look at various things like that. We look at the demand in a particular area, what's the supply situation in that particular area to give us a view of what the long-term play with that in that area would be, whether, you know, to limit the downside for any investment coming in to protect their capital.
And that's how you crunch the numbers on these things?
Among many other things. So these are sort of your back of the envelope, high level, where we look at it, first screen, it qualifies, and we look at more deeper in, because you got to look at a lot of other variables such as service charges, what's the cost of carrying that in the case that you cannot rent the property and so forth. Does it make sense on a long-term basis? What's the equity story for it in the long term?
Sadiq, thanks so much for your time. Sadiq Farid, founder and CEO of Smart Crowd. Lynette Abad, director of research and data at Property Finder. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you for listening. We are back Sunday, 6 a.m., Business Breakfast Breakfast. Have a really good weekend.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.